Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
The master Fugai was considered very wise and generous, yet he was most severe, both with himself and his disciples. He went to the mountains to sit in meditation. He lived in a cave, and when he was hungry, he went to the village for food. One day, a monk called Bundo, attracted by Fugai's austerities, called at the cave and asked to stay the night. The master seemed happy to put him up, and the next morning prepared some rice gruel for him. And not having an extra bowl, he went out and returned with a skull that he found near a tomb. He filled it with the gruel and offered it to Bundo. And the guest refused to touch it and stared at Fugai as if he had gone mad. And at this, Fugai became furious and drove him out of the cave with blows. "Fool," he shouted after him, "how can you, with your worldly notions of purity and filth, think yourself a Buddhist?" Yeah. Some months later, the master Tetsu visited him and told him it was a great pity that he had forsaken the world. I'm going up there to live in a cave. Fugai laughed at him and he said, "Oh, it's easy enough to forsake the world. The difficult thing is to become a true Buddhist." Or we could say Zenist, or whatever word you want to use in there. We don't need to use Buddhist, huh? Yeah. Now, somewhere along the line, I have read that somebody said that there are two types of religions. There's two ways of approaching the truth, in other words. One is the way of the heart, which includes then Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and this man put in Hinduism. In the path of the heart, one is supposed to finally be just dissolved in the beloved, you know, in the divine. You're just dissolved and you become not, because you're so enmeshed with the divine, huh? And the other way, the other path, is of the mind. And this includes Buddhism, Jainism, Taoism, and Zen. Now, I don't entirely agree with this. This is this and this is this, huh? Because certainly there are those in Christianity who have given great thought and a lot of effort to understanding. I mean, we have people like Meister Eckhart, and you can't say that this is not of the mind, his approach. You know, in the order of the Benedictine monks, we have people like Brother David Standel Rast, who certainly is very mind-oriented. And there are those in the Benedictine monks who have taken up Zen, the Zen practice, and brought it back into the communities. And then, of course, also within that Christian realm, we have the Jesuits. And you would not say that is of the heart. But they have their and tremendously intellectual. Those of you who remember Father, what was his name, Sheen? Yeah, any relative? Though he was quite a man, boy. Now, it's true that Judaism and the Islam thing, you know, they're quite emotional. And of course, it depends a lot, I think, on what part of the world you're in. If you go to Italy, why, and into the Middle East, you know, here is this tremendous emotion, whether you're a Christian or Islam or Jewish. It's very interesting. Anyway, and Hinduism, I mean, a lot of the people in Hinduism, because the Hindu people themselves are very emotional, but within the teaching, we find the great, within the tradition, we find the great teachers like Kapila and Samkhya, you know, Vivekananda, yeah, and the Vedanta society thing, which is in Hinduism. And here we have, in Hinduism, the path of the bhakti, of the heart, and we have Janani, which is the head, you know. And one certainly cannot say that Buddhism is bereft of the heart, for after all, you know, look at the many, many hundreds of people that pray to Kuan'an, you know, the compassionate Buddha. I mean, tremendous love there in Buddhism. Mm. But by and large in this country, you know, so the whole thing is really pretty mixed up. And you are, whatever aspect of it, of the tradition, you follow that which you are, basically. The religion of the heart in the Western world is a religion of contemplation and prayer. And the religion of the mind is the religion of meditation. And the word meditation that we use is from the Sanskrit jhana, which became chana in China and zen in Japan. But the Western world has not really known very much of this jhana, except maybe the Jesuits. So we do not have a correct translation of this word. We call it meditation. So meditation is meditation. You know, like attention is attention. Meditation, the word we use meditation, comes from the Greek root medonao, which means to think about. Meditation is not thinking about, is it? It means, the medonao means to contemplate. See? And so I went to the dictionary to look up this. I finally went to the dictionary and looked up this word meditation. And I quote what it says. A discourse intended to express one's reflections. Or to guide others in contemplation, to muse over, to ponder. Now, the word meditation that we use, you know, jhana, means not to think about. See, just the opposite. It means how to be in a state of no thought. How to come to a point or to a place where you are, but only you are in awareness. Not all these other gobbledygooks, huh? But, you know, meditation is the only word that we have, so we use it. So therefore, I usually like to say we sit for meditation, and the meditation I'm talking about is jhana, not contemplation, not where you can sit there and argue with yourself as to this is good and this is bad. Yeah. Now, when this man Buddha attained enlightenment, he began this teaching of the state of no mind, which doesn't mean that you haven't got a mind. There is nobody alive in this world that doesn't have a mind. There are a lot of people that don't think well, and there are a lot of people that don't think. Well, what do people in institutions do? Do they think? I think they think. See, and that's, you know, so anyway, it was an interesting thought that went by. But, I mean, there's all kinds of thoughts going by, you know, when I'm up here talking, and sometimes I'll grab one and say, look at that, isn't that neat? But this no mind just simply means a state of not thinking. And the mind is very present, but it is the mind as such, the mind itself, and not the activity of it. There's a difference. But it's called in the Orient no mind. Or that's how we've translated it, no mind. And the Buddha, when he began to teach, he had all this analysis, very analytical, that he espoused. He had the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Twelvefold Dependent Originations, you know, which down through the centuries, this man Nagarjuna picked up and further developed, you know, because then we have the right thinking and the right remembering and the right mind and mindfulness, all of which comes out of Buddhism and the Madhyamika sect or the Abhatamsaka. Yeah. And so one becomes, in meditation or in trying to reach a state of meditation, and Vivekananda has the different states outlined very well. You know, he starts with the asana, which is the position you assume, and then you go step by step from there into pranayama, you know, watching the breath, and then you come to the next step, and the next step, and the next step, and finally you come to jhana, and you've hit meditation. And then after that comes samadhi, and then after that comes super samadhi. Right? Okay. Now, in sitting, trying to practice meditation so that one can become a meditator, one becomes more and more aware of the thoughts. So that you're watching the thoughts. You're not involved with them. And you're not identified with them. You're just watching them, you know. You're observing. See? You're observing. Oh, yeah, see? That way is being caught out there is observing, huh? So you stand aside and watch as if you're standing by the side of the road and watching the traffic go by. You know the old saying? They used to have this on the radio about this guy sitting on the porch and watch the Fords go by. Long time ago, you remember that? You don't? Oh, yeah, it was a big ad for years. You sit there and you watch the Fords go by. So you watch the thoughts go by. Maybe that'll a little bit help you do it, huh? All these Fords going by. Maybe you can throw in a Chevy or two, huh? Right? Yeah. So if you're watching, and really watching, now and not involved in them, you'll see it quite readily, that thoughts are very repetitive. You know, we go on thinking the same thing, and therefore we go on doing the same thing. Again and again and again and again. All these going by, forwards, huh? And if you observe carefully, you will see by and by you will become aware of the circle in which these thoughts are moving. Round and around and around they go, and always back to the same point. No wonder we're dizzy, huh? Now, one should be able to see this about oneself, because once you can see the thoughts going by, and that they are going round, always the same point always seems to come up, you know? And if you can really see that, at that moment, you will become, with that aspect, that point, non-identified. You break that identification for that moment. That circle is broken. If you observe, and it's a big if, because people say, I keep looking, I keep looking, I keep looking, and finally one day, after months of looking and looking and looking, they say, oh, I saw a flower I never saw before. That's not what I'm after. But if you look, you will see that it's the same emotion going by, the same anger, the same greed, the same ego-centeredness. You haven't allowed it to change at all. We sit here and allow ourselves to be victims of our own thinking. We're supposed to be the masters of ourselves, not victims, you know. So step aside. That's all you have to do, is step aside. You don't need to be involved. The thoughts are going to come and go, and they're going to come and go, and they're going to come and go. They're not even concerned with you if you will look at them. So you don't need to lend them your cooperation so that you can remain a victim. Right? Everybody agrees with me. I hope not. If don't, you will find out. Now, the path of prayer doesn't have much analysis in it. You just dissolve into this prayer state, and love is the goal. You should be loving and kind and gentle, you know. You should be so full of love that the ego dissolves into the love. It just melts into the love. It's not easy, you know, either. Now, on the path of prayer, God is very necessary. I think we can understand that without a lot of explanation. You know, you're praying for this love. And to whom are you praying? God. What else? You're not going to pray to me or your next door neighbor or the dogs and the cats. You know, God is the one to whom you direct your prayers. So in the path of love, God is very necessary. However, on the path of meditation, God is not so necessary. If you really learn to meditate, if you really learn, you will find out what God is. But you will not need to think about his attributes. You will not need to endow him with a lot of what you think he should be or her should be. I mean, there is this new sect rising. God is a woman. You don't need to endow with a great this or the great that. God is the greatest in the world. Just find out. That's all it asks. Find out for yourself. Prove it. Find out what is. When you find God, no matter what path you're on, you will find there is tremendous love. It not only fills the heart, it fills all of you. But it is not a personal love. It is a kind of a carrying love. It'll carry you, you know, as if you were a babe in arms. It is not personal. It is God's love. I don't know how else to say it. It's God's love. It's a love greater than we know. It is a vast, immeasurable love. It's love. Until we know that, we don't really know love is a... This is but one experiences as what we call God's love is love. Yeah. So that on this path of prayer now, and trying to find this love, one becomes drunk with God, so filled with joy. You lose your senses in God. On the path of meditation, you must remain alert. There must be the alertness. In both paths, the ego disappears. If you are truly, fully alert, there's no ego. If you are fully immersed in the love so that you're drunk with it, you know, the ego disappears. Because in true love, the ego can't remain. If the ego is present, it is not this, what is called agape love. Yeah? So in either case, the ego disappears. And this agape, the Greeks had several words for love. And it's one of them is eros. Now that's a physical love. That's a love that a man has for woman and woman has for man. That's eros. And then there is philios, which is a brotherly love. It's a love that you have for everybody in here. You know, we're brothers and sisters in the Dharma. This is philios. And so, you know, like the city of Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love. And then we have this word agape. We don't know how to translate it in the Western world. Love. But it's God's love. See? And the New Testament was written in Greek. And when the translators came to this word agape, they didn't know what to do with it. Because here are all these different kinds of love that the Greeks talk about. And here's agape. We have no word for it. So they put in charity. Faith, hope, and charity. These three. Love. When one is in this love, and it is an all-consuming thing, you know, so that the ego is not. And when the ego is not, you come to know what truth is. Now, in the years to come, I think Western Zen will have more and more of a place, or we can say we'll have deeper and deeper roots in this country because of our attitude towards science. Science and Zen are quite compatible. The use of the mind. A scientist, you know, is researching and researching and researching to the very basics of something. Before an answer to a problem. I mean, look at what they've come up with trying to find out. What is this? You know, well, it's energy. Well, let us find out what the energy is about. And so we get to the atom. And we thought we had the indivisible little particular out of which the universe was made. And then they found out that wasn't so. You know, now we have photons and electrons and neutrons and quarks and, you know, going back further and further, and they still haven't really come to what this energy is. You know, they're looking down into the very fundamental. And in a like manner, You know, meditation in Zen goes to the roots of the mind and doesn't ask you to believe in anything. Just research yourself. It doesn't ask that you believe in a particular something. It says, better not believe. Find out what's going on. Yeah? So it is said it has no superstition. And the superstition comes from a Latin superstace root, which means that something survives. The something that survives is becomes superstition. It's a remnant from the past is a superstition. Things that persist out of a habit are superstition. So why hang on to your habits? That's not going to get you to the fundamental roots, is what Zen is saying. Now, prayer. Prayer can be something that is other than just repeating words. Am I boring you? Oh, well, I mean, you know, I heard you falling asleep. Prayer is not, you don't mind. No, I didn't think so, not after being with Henry. It'd be nice if I could spread it around a little bit. I can with David every now and then, and I do with Willie now and then. They handle it somewhat well. Anyway, I have to tell you. Yeah, another thought went by. Speaking of remembering, last week I went over to Palomar, and Gene Sager, you know, who runs the class over there in World Religions. He got up and he said something very nice about himself. He was talking about me and some of the experiences that had gone on along the line, and he said in one day, one time when she was here talking, he said I was preoccupied with the papers, you know, that he had in his lap and everything. And she very gently, unobtrusively, did her little thing to show that I was not paying attention. And he said she did it so neatly, nobody else in the room knew that that's what was going on, that he was not paying attention. Anyway, prayer. I thought that was very nice of him to say that in front of his students, you know, that he can look that well at himself and not feel that he has to be up on a pedestal. Prayer. When in the course of meditation there comes this presence, when this presence is felt, prayer is possible. We could also recite an experience. Last week we went to a funeral, and the priest, one of the priests, they had a Monsignor and a priest running it, and the particular priest, one priest was a brother of the man who died, and when he did, he gave a little talk, you know, thanking the Monsignor for letting him participate. And he said then, you know, because I have lost a brother. Rachel has lost a husband. The children have lost a father. You have lost a friend. And God has gained a saint. And when he said it, it was really something. And when he did the rite of the Mass, when he celebrated the Mass, the presence was there, the host was there. Makes all the difference in the world, not just repeating something. There's a real presence. Then one can pray. But no words. It's this presence. You know, and in this presence, to whom do you give your heart? To whom do you give your mind? You know? If this presence is felt in you, you are in prayer. Other than that, you're repeating words, huh? Yeah. In this presence, you know, there is silence. An overwhelming silence, huh? At this prayer, in this silence, this presence, you know, is what prayer is all about. Yeah. You know, one evening there was this priest from America, and he was visiting Ireland, naturally, St. Patrick's Day, huh? And, yeah, and this priest was walking along the road, and he came upon an elderly gentleman. And they walked along together then, enjoying the evening. And all of a sudden a storm blew up, and they took shelter somewhere along the road. Could have been a little barn. They have little barns there. Yeah. Anyway, while they're in this shelter, they're talking together. And then as the rain came down, pretty soon there was just this silence. Very friendly there they were together. Very silent. And this old man took out a prayer book and he began to pray. And this American priest, observing him, was struck very deeply, you know, by a certain kind of hallowedness, let us say, around this old gentleman who was a priest as he prayed. And quite unintentionally, he couldn't stop himself. The words were out of his mouth before he could think. He said out loud, you know, you must be very close to God. It was this presence around this old priest that, you know, there's this. And the old man paused and looked at him, and he kind of smiled, and he says, yes, he's very fond of me. What a nice place to be in, huh? He is very fond of me. So it is not only a question of that you love God, you know, or that you are seeking God, but to feel this love, see, flowing around you, covering you, welling up inside of you, you know. As I say, if this is present, prayer is possible. And this presence is so all-consuming that you as ego are not. Meditation is. Hmm? And in the meanwhile, we practice. Right? Yeah. Okay. Now, this Master Fugai was considered very wise and generous, and yet he was most severe, both with himself and his disciples. So we do know that Zen is something one just doesn't read about in a book. It is an encounter with reality. Hmm? And in understanding that, one can be severe. It's not a game to be playing just to be playing. Once you enter Zen, and I'm not saying how long it's going to take before you enter Zen. It may take you 20 minutes. It may take you a lifetime. But once you enter the world of Zen, or the courtyard of Zen, it is called, you will never be the same again. Hmm? The person who enters the Zen practice and stays with it, and the individual who comes out of the knot hole on the other end, are not the same individual. Mm-hmm. The one going in has lots of hope, you know, hoping, huh? The one at the other end is knowing. In knowing, there is this strength, you know. And the hope It keeps you hopping. Yeah. It does, huh? Somewhere between the going in and the going out, or shall we say the finished product, huh? You drop the past. You pick it up again, parts of it, huh? Not all of it. Because some of it has been resolved in yourself. Some of it we must have in order to relate. These are our experiences in which we relate to others. Hmm? But the identification with it is dropped. Hmm? Hmm? You understand that? And when you drop all the identifications with an experience and you pick this up again because it's in your psychic world, of course, you know, there's a difference. You know, in this transcending, it's called, huh? Going beyond the thinking and the emotions. See, it goes beyond the past and the future. It is now. We say this all the time. The yes and going beyond the yes and the no of our thinking. So going beyond the yes and the no we call transcending. And in that state, one is beyond time as we know it, and one is beyond space as we know it. And now, Einstein came up with the theory that time and space are not two separate things. They are two aspects of one, you know. So he called it spatio-time, time being the fourth dimension of space. So one who transcends is beyond time and space. If you transcend, when you transcend space, time, where are you? And if you transcend time, space, when are you? Yeah. Well, it doesn't need any definitions of time and space. What is freedom. Yeah. So in the world as you have known it up to that point is not at that time. And something seemingly new to me, seemingly, it is not new, but it is seemingly new, so this something quite indescribable rises in you. So a Zen master, a Zen teacher, can and does at times become very severe. Because he is trying to push you to the point where you will surrender so that you can transcend. So you will drop. Surrender is very difficult. There are many stages to go through before one can surrender. First of all, what is it you are going to surrender? It's very easy to say, I will surrender my way of thinking. That's from the top of the head, isn't it? Do it. Don't just say it, you know. Or one can say, I will surrender my jealousy. Well, that's baggage I'd like to be rid of, so it's pretty easy to surrender. Yeah? Or I will surrender my selfishness. Yeah. And then one day you may say something to the effect, well, I will surrender my will to God's will. And then somewhere down the line, God's will flows into you, and through you, that strength, that will, huh? And you will know how silly your words were. Yeah. In anyway, this Fugai was very wise and generous, and yet he was severe, both with himself and his disciples. And so he went to the mountains to sit in meditation. So we have this, he's up sitting in this cave in the mountains doing zazen, sitting silently and not doing, just not doing. And, you know, the rest of us, all the time what we're doing. We do. The inner thinking is doing and doing and doing. Whenever you want anything, the mind immediately begins to plan. How are you going to do this? See, all the time we're doing, but simply sitting. Not to think in terms of doing. Just sit. If you're going to think at all, think in terms of being. Not doing. Being. Just be. Difficult. Having something to do you kind of like because it keeps you preoccupied. You know, you don't have to cope with it quite so much. You know, you're still somebody. You don't have to face yourself preoccupied with doing. Sometimes doing is an escape so you can avoid looking at yourself. So we do 1,001 things, most of which are totally unnecessary. Not only unnecessary, but we are creating with this doing a lot of trouble for ourselves and for others. Let's not forget that. The minute you've got trouble, you know, you're not alone in the world, you have trouble for others. Believe me. People ask, well, what should we meditate upon? You know? Or maybe we should chant. Should we chant? Yeah. No, you do nothing. Just breathe. You learn how to breathe, that's something in itself already. Just let the body relax and let the mind settle into the body. Let everything about you just settle. It all comes down to the ground. You go down to the ground with it, except that you're paying attention and just settling. If you're going to get in there and do, you know, you're going to interfere. Well, that's what we do all the time. We interfere, and we make a muddle out of things even more than they're already muddled. So you just sit on the bank and let the river flow. Maybe you could count the fish, but let the river flow. It's true that a seeker in Zen may sit for many years and nothing seems to happen. But then finally, there comes a light. At a time when everything is so silent, there isn't a flicker of energy. It is just a silent solidity within. There's no occupation. There are no fragments. There are no bits and pieces, just this deep silence. And all of a sudden, one comes face to face with being. Being has to do with a true man of no rank. You know that little koan? Look, you beginners, look. There is a true man of no rank leaving and entering the gates of your face. Who is this true man of no rank? Anyway, this man, he went to the mountains to sit in Zen, Zazen. He lived in a cave, and when he was hungry, he went to the village for food. Well, monks have been in China and Japan, have been doing this for centuries. And they go about their business, and then they go in the village for food. They go on begging trips, and then they come back. They used to have to beg more for food than they do today. Today, people give them money, don't they, once in a while? Sure. meal of rice and some money. And then they go back to sitting. Settling in. Going within. Stop clinging to the thoughts. Stop clinging to the attitudes. Stop clinging to the moods. Don't cling to anything. Just sit there and fall in. And in. And in. And in. And deeper. And deeper. Just don't go to sleep now. You know, just fall in deeper and deeper until you reach the center. Have you ever heard about anybody that was troubled by the within center? That within center has never troubled anyone. No. And that within center, the very core of you, is available. The problem you have, of course, is that you're standing with your back to it. Turn around. Now, our doing. Oh, we've got to be active, you know. Our doing. Activity is the world. And when the Zennists say, leave the world, you know, leave the house, leave the market, go into seclusion, you know, they mean leave the attachment thereto, the attachment to activity. Whatever you're doing, you know, Jesus said, go into thy closet. And in secret, you pray. You don't run around being active, you know? Whatever you're doing, whatever activity, even right now, you're supposed to be listening. So, in the middle of the listening, meditate. Hold your focus of attention. You eat. You keep right on eating. But within yourself, you're meditating. You're holding a focus of attention. You walk. Keep right on walking. Hold your focus of attention. Someone jumps you. Let them. You keep your focus of attention. Don't get rattled by it. By and by, with this kind of practice of focusing attention, you know, by and by that inner posture is attained, you know. Then one can do things, that is, one can be active and not be in the activity. See? Be in the world, but not of it. Taoism now calls this Wei Wu Wei, action, non-action. Inside, focus of attention. Whatever there is to do, you do, but you're not identified with it. And then one day, a monk named Bundo, attracted by Fugai's austerities. I mean, some people are attracted by austerities because of the severity, because they know it leads to something, you know. Anyway, he called at the cave and he asked to spend the night. And the master seemed happy to put him up, and the next morning prepared this rice gruel. And not having an extra bowl, he went out and returned with a skull that he found lying near the tomb. And he filled the skull with the gruel, and he offered it to Bundo. And Bundo refused it, he wouldn't touch it, and he stared at this Fugai as if he were crazy, offering somebody a skull with breakfast in it. Well, you could accept it and not say anything, and it would be a big ego trip. That's one way. Or you can be on a big ego trip and refuse to touch it like this Bundo did. Yeah. You know, Henry tells of a time when he was at a dinner with Gurdjieff. And, you know, Gurdjieff always prepared the food. And there were 13, 14 courses. And between every course, of course, was drinking the Applejack brandy and the, anyway. And you were supposed to drink. Women, they were given a third of a glass, and a man had a full glass Armagnac. And you were supposed to drink it down, boys. And so anyway, it came on this thing in the end that you had a, I guess it was a pig. The head and all was brought to the table. Couldn't have been a pig. Out of Islam. Whatever it was. Peacock? Could be. Anyway, eyes and all, you see. So he wanted to know who was going to eat the eye. And of course somebody did. And when they got all through, he was very angry with them. He said, that's nothing but an ego trip. You see, we do things like that. Now, however, there is another yet. The individual who knows, real deep within himself, that this whole reality, the totality, you know, consists of one fundamental force. See, one energy. One energy that has different states. And different states take different forms. Energy may have long waves, energy can have short waves. I gotta put some frequencies in there someplace, don't I? No. The long waves and the short waves, they appear different. But it is still one energy. So then what's wrong with the skull? It's an empty bowl. The bowl and the skull are both made of earth. Energy, earth energy. So if it's presented to you, what do? You either realize or you condemn that he's crazy, or you do it out of ego. You have three choices. But this little Bundo wouldn't touch the skull. And with this Fugai became furious, and he drove him out of the cave with blows. Must have had a good stick, huh? Fool, he shouts after him, you know, how can you, with your worldly notions of filth and purity, think yourself to be a Buddhist? Now, to say this is beautiful and that is ugly are notions in us. Nothing is beautiful and nothing is ugly. Except, as Shakespeare said, except the thinking makes it so. Let us say that on this planet there was a tremendous catastrophe, and man, that is including woman, generic man, just disappeared. No human beings left around at all. But all the rest, everything remained the same. The earth is the same. The flowers flower. Will they be beautiful? Birds are going to sing like crazy, like they do now. Who are they singing for? You? They just sing. Everything will be itself, just as it is, without any evaluation, because the valuer disappeared. See? All of nature, have you ever seen nature out there without any ego involved in your seeing it? There is such contentment. There is such peace out there. It's indescribable, the contentment in nature. Nothing strives against anything else. The bees run around and get their pollen, and the birds are singing, and the grass is growing. And what is the old saying? And the Buddha is on the tip of every blade of grass. Now, there isn't any high and there isn't any low. There isn't any taller and there isn't any shorter. There isn't any beautiful and there isn't any ugly. It's just peace. We discriminate. Non-discrimination is of the no mind. Yep. Now, this little Fugai, what he actually was trying to do, he probably had another bowl. You know, other people did come to see him. So, but he was trying to create a situation for this poor Bundo. And Bundo missed. Fugai was doing this, you know, as a device so that this, you know, so something would awaken this little man. He was shaking him, trying to pull him out of his dreams of like and dislike, of purity and filth, of beautiful and ugly, of good and bad. If you have no purity, what happens to filth? Yeah. You know, there's a story about a monk. And this is what passes for meditation for most. This monk is sitting for meditation, and day after day he sits, and he sits, and he sits. And one day, let's say he's sitting out there under a tree by a nice rock, you know, and he's sitting there. And he sits there maybe 3 hours every day, every day, every day. And one day his Roshi comes by and looks at him sitting there, and he picks up a brick and he sits down alongside of him. And he starts to polish this brick. Now, this sound of this Roshi polishing this brick is distracting, and it disturbs this young monk. You know, it would disturb me too. And so finally, he opens his eyes and he turns around and he looks at the Roshi and he says, "What are you doing?" And the Roshi says, "I'm trying to make a mirror." And the monk is so exasperated, you know, that by polishing a brick, you can't make a mirror. Mirrors aren't made that way. And the Roshi says, "Then why are you trying to polish your mind?"
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.